And when you give humans a certain extent of power, humans will, in a lot of situations, abuse that power. And I think I saw that firsthand a lot when I was serving in the military, is that there were certain people that just, they felt because they had a rank, it made them more important. Like, you know, I'm not important in the roles of E1 through E4, but oh, now that I'm an E5, I'm going to tell you what to do and you're going to listen to me because I'm an E5 and I told you to. Oh, and now I'm an E6 and oh, E7. Oh my God, I'm going to tell you to do this. Otherwise, I'm going to make sure that you don't get what you want to get in your career. And I experienced this firsthand.
Welcome to Your Story Doesn't End Here, the mental health podcast of military and veterans who refuse to be silenced. I'm your host, Rachel, and my mission with this podcast is to be a voice for those who don't have a voice, bring awareness to mental health issues, provide value and solutions, and to change the culture when it comes to mental health within the DoD organizations.
Hey everyone, thank you for coming back for another episode of Your Story Doesn't End Here. Last week's podcast episode, we talked a little bit about the Stanford prison experiment. And I don't typically do podcast episodes like this, but I thought that this would be an important one to break down a little more. We didn't have a whole lot of time in that episode to really talk about what the Stanford prison experiment was and how that really relates, in my mind, at least, to military and leadership and power dynamics. But I figured we'd take a little bit of time to just break it down a little bit more and see how that psychologically compares to military leadership and the power dynamics that exist in the military, not only in the old school military, but that still exists in today's military, whether you want to call that new school or whatever you want to call it. I think there's still a mixture of both schools, as you will. So anyway, I pulled up an article from the American Psychological Association that breaks down the Stanford Prison Experiment. And the title of the article is Demonstrating the Power of Social Situations Via a Simulated Prison Environment. So some of the stuff I'm going to read verbatim, I will post the actual link to whatever I'm reading off of in the show notes for anyone that wants to dive deeper, but I wanted to take maybe 30 minutes or so and just dive into this together to just kind of look more from a psychological standpoint at mental health and leadership in the military. So a little bit different, but I'm super excited for this one today. So the article starts by saying in 1971, a team of psychologists designed and executed an unusual experiment that used a mock prison setting with college students role-playing prisoners and guards to test the power of the social situation to determine behavior. The research known as the Stanford Prison Experiment has become a classic demonstration of situational power to influence individual attitudes, values, and behaviors. So extreme, swift, and unexpected were the transformations of character and many of the participants that the study planned to last 2 weeks had to be terminated by the sixth day. And so I touched on a few of these things on the last episode because I just kind of pulled stuff up on the fly while I was interviewing my guest last week, Tyler. But this is really interesting to me because when you look at the power dynamic that exists in the military, you have this rank-based structure. And I don't know that the military would do well on a non-rank-based structure. I think that the rank is a very important part of what makes the military, but when you start to give people this unlimited amount of power and it's not regulated and people aren't really saying anything, like they're standing by and watching things happen, because maybe they're afraid to say something, or maybe tradition or old school or whatever you want to call it. I really don't know why people act the way they act in the military. It can sometimes create a very toxic environment. Sometimes it takes the flip side approach and it creates a very empowering environment. It's not this way every time, but let's dig a little bit deeper into the Stanford Prison Experiment and see what actually happened here. So, findings. A person-centered analysis of human behavior attributes most behavioral change in positive or negative directions to internal dispositional features of individuals. The factors commonly believed to direct behavior are to be found in the operation of genes, temperament, personality traits, personal pathologies, and virtues. A situation-centered approach, in contrast, focuses on the factors external to the person, to the behavioral context in which individuals are functioning. Although human behavior is almost always a function of the interaction of person and situation, social psychologists have called attention to the attributional biases and much of psychology and among the general public that overestimates the importance of dispositional factors while underestimating situational factors. A lot of big words that basically mean that there's a lot more to human behavior than just one or two things. Genes, temperament, personality, virtues, all the things, all attribute to human behavior. I feel like because I'm reading an article from American Psychology Today, they throw in all these really, really big unnecessary words. And so I probably should have read through this and summarized it ahead of time, but I do everything on the fly. So this is what it is. So the Stanford Prison Experiment extended that analysis to demonstrate the surprisingly profound impact of institutional forces on the behavior of normal, healthy participants. Philip Zimbardo, PhD, and his research team of Craig Haney, Curtis Banks, David Jaffe, and ex-convict consultant Carlo Prescott designed a study that separated the usual dispositional factors among correctional personnel and prisoners from the situational factors that characterize many prisons. They wanted to determine what prison-like settings bring out in people that are not confounded by what people bring into prisons. They sought to discover to what extent the violence and antisocial behaviors often found in prisons can be traced to the quote-unquote bad apples that go into prison or to the quote-unquote bad barrels, the prisons themselves, that can corrupt behavior of even ordinary good people. So you might think, well, Rachel, we're talking about a prison here. We're not talking about the military. They're two different situations, and I get it. Not all military bases feel like prisons, but when we look from a behavioral standpoint, and even some actual physical standpoints, there are some bases that really feel quite prison-like. I mean, I remember in my very first command, the room that I was in had no windows. We were locked in, you know, a secret room that had a code to get into it. And there are some places that just feel a little prisony. I've never been to prison, so I can't say that for sure. But anyway, let's keep reading so we can get more context here. So the study was conducted this way. College students from all over the United States who answered a city newspaper ad for participants in a study of prison life were personally interviewed, given a battery of personality tests, and completed background surveys that enabled the researchers to pre-select only those who were mentally and physically healthy, normal, and well-adjusted. So this is really key here, is that these people were evaluated to be mentally, physically, and normal and well-adjusted. I think we could equate that to MEPS, which is supposed to also determine that people who enter the military are mentally and physically healthy, normal, and well-adjusted. They were randomly assigned to role play either prisoners or guards in a simulated prison setting constructed in the basement of Stanford University's psychology department. The prison setting was designed as functional simulation of the central features present in the psychology of imprisonment. And read a full description of the methodology, chronology of daily events, transmission, human character that were revealed. Oh, they don't. The full description is not. Okay, so I'm not going to click on the full description right now because I'm just trying to get a summary of this. Maybe we'll come back to that in a second. But the major results of the study can be summarized as: many of the normal, healthy mock prisoners suffered such intense emotional stress reactions that they had to be released in a matter of days. Most of the other prisoners acted like zombies, totally obeying the demeaning orders of the guards. The distress of the prisoners was caused by their sense of powerlessness induced by the guards, who began acting in cruel, dehumanizing, and even sadistic ways. The study was terminated prematurely because it was getting out of control in the extent of degrading actions being perpetrated by the guards against the prisoners, all of whom had been normal, healthy, ordinary young college students less than a week before. So what is the significance of this study? It's become one of psychology's most dramatic illustrations of how good people can be transformed into perpetrators of evil, and healthy people can begin to experience pathological reactions traceable to situational forces. Its messages have been carried in many textbooks in the social sciences and classroom lectures across many nations and in popular media renditions. This website's gotten over 15 million, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's that. There's a lot of fluff in this article. But I think the biggest thing here, and I'm going to keep skimming through this article to see what else I find relevant, is that human behavior is such an interesting thing. And when you give humans a certain extent of power, humans will in a lot of situations abuse that power. And I think I saw that firsthand a lot when I was serving in the military, is that there were certain people that just, they felt because they had a rank, it made them more important. Like, you know, I'm not important in the roles of E1 through E4, but oh, now that I'm an E5, I'm going to tell you what to do and you're going to listen to me because I'm an E5 and I told you to. Oh, and now I'm an E6 and oh, E7. Oh my God. I'm going to tell you to do this. Otherwise, I'm going to make sure that you don't get what you want to get in your career. And I experienced this firsthand. I mean, doing what I could do to do my job and then being told, oh no, you can't go to school in your off time because you didn't do what we wanted you to do in the order we wanted you to do it. Things like that. And it's a very mild example compared to what we talked about last week with Tyler's story, like physically starving someone in a boot camp situation. I still think is not okay at all, but it just goes to show what humans are capable of. And in an environment where it is almost accepted because there's a group of people who are afraid to speak up. And then there's another group of people who are also afraid to speak up. It's just because they're new and they're a younger rank and they feel like their career could be over, and it absolutely could be over if they speak up. I mean, a lot of people dare not to say anything in boot camp. That is a huge reason why I think boot camp was so weird for the females in my division, because the RDCs at RTC Great Lakes had been hounded about sexual assault prevention and how to treat females and males and everyone alike. And like, people just don't know how to be just genuine people. They don't, a lot of people don't know how to turn on a strict and stern without being mean or without pulling a power dynamic, because that is the main example that's shown to us in the world of how to be a leader is, you know, I am a certain rank, so you will respect me. And if you don't respect me, I'm just going to yell at you until I get my way. And this is not just in the world of the military. We see this in parenting a lot too. And it's something that I have to check myself on quite a bit as a parent of, well, what's going to serve my daughter the best? If I just yell at her and hit her and put her in a corner, that's not going to do anything. And, you know, and spankings are controversial. Personally, I was raised with spankings. And that's one of the reasons why I don't think that they're effective, because it hit a certain point where I was just like, oh, well, you get the spanking, you move on with your life. And like, that's it, right? There's really no like deep lesson instilled there. There was no conversation. There was no, this is what's going to serve you later into your adult life. It was just like, oh, well, you fuck up, you get in trouble, you move on with your life. And so, you know, whole different conversation there. But I'm reading further in this article here under practical application, and it actually does mention the Navy SEER program. It says a video documentary of the study Quiet Rage, the Stanford Prison Experiment, has been used extensively by many agencies within the civilian and military criminal justice system, as well as in shelters for abused women, and also used to educate role-playing military interrogators in the Navy SEER program, Survival, Evasion, and Resistance, on the potential dangers of abusing their power against others while role-playing pretend spies and terrorists. And so for those of you who don't know what the Navy SEER program is, like I said, it stands for Survival, Evasion, and Resistance. And I know quite a few people who have been through the SEER program. I actually wanted to go through it just to say I did it. That wasn't on my like career path. I wasn't air crew or anything that had to do with SEER. But essentially, SEER is giving, placing members of the military, the trainees, in a scenario where they're simulating being prisoners of war. So they have to survive, evade, escape, all these things. I talked to people who said like, yeah, we lived off of like an onion and an apple for a week, lost a shit ton of weight. I can't remember exactly if they get beat now or if they're just like humiliated or like stripped down. I know that they're placed in like cells and have to listen to like the same song over and over. I don't know. Never been through it. Can't speak through a personal experience. And I think it is still one of those things that's supposed to be kept like secretive so that you don't really fully know what it's like until you go through it, which I don't disagree with. I think certain things like that, like if you're in a prisoner of war scenario, you don't know what they're going to do to you ahead of time. It's not like they give you like a like a rundown, an agenda, like, oh, at 10 o'clock, we're going to strip you down. And then 11 o'clock, we're going to put you in the cell. And then at 11:30, you're going to listen to the same song over and over for the next 10 hours. And then we'll wake you up for dinner time. Like, you just don't get that rundown anyway. And so I think that element of surprise going into training, it's intentional. And again, I don't disagree with that. But if you search Navy SEER, there are tons of videos. I mean, we live in the information age now, so nothing's really fully a secret. I'm looking at like 4 YouTube videos. 3 of them are directly from the US Navy. So clearly the Navy is not making it a full secret anymore these days. But it's interesting that they use the Stanford Prison Experiment to train these people who their actual job, like the purpose of SEER, is to break people down in a prisoner of war scenario. That is not the purpose of boot camp. And so, you know, I'm still like slightly bothered by the fact that there are people out there that are doing this kind of thing in boot camp situations. And I'm sure there are people out there that are doing this kind of thing in just regular command training situations and all the things alike. When you go to the Stanford Prison Experiment website, prisonexp.org, I clicked on the full experiment link that I alluded to earlier. And there is a bold section. It's a sentence that says, "What happens when you put good people in an evil place? Does humanity win over evil, or does evil triumph?" These are some of the questions we posed in this dramatic simulation of prison life conducted in 1971 at Stanford University. And then there's a quote from Professor Philip G. Zimbardo that says, "How we went about testing these questions and what we found may astound you. Our planned 2-week investigation into the psychology of prison life had to be ended after only 6 days because of what the situation was doing to the college students who participated. In only a few days, our guards became sadistic and our prisoners became depressed and showed signs of extreme stress. Please read the story of what happened and what it tells us about the nature of human nature." Oh, here's the story. I'm going to read the story. Is this the story? Yes, maybe. I don't know. I'm going to read the story anyway, because it sounds intriguing. Maybe. Oh, nope. Now it's just taking me to a bunch of weird links. We clicked out of that. So anyway, there's a lot of YouTube videos online. There's a lot of articles online, and you can really get into this massive rabbit hole about what happened in this experiment. But I think it just goes to show at the end of the day that if you place humans under the right conditions with a certain amount of power, that humans will take full advantage of that power in most scenarios. Not every human, you're always going to have your outliers, but what does that say for the rank structure in the military? And what does that say for the people below that feel like they can't speak up because of rank structure in the military? And something we talked about last week as well was how it's really hard for people to speak up to the really high ranking people in the military, because when you have your, you know, open forum speaking engagement or open forum anything or open door policy, it's always filtered. There's always someone ahead of time who's like, yeah, you know, the highest ranking member of the military is about to come talk to us in whatever branch, but we're going to make sure you filter all the questions through us first. I still remember to this day, and I can't remember if I've shared this on the podcast, but it was the what was he? I've been out of the military for like 2 years and I'm already forgetting all of the ranks. He was the CNO, I think, Chief of Naval Operations. So CNO comes to the base, NASWI, and is speaking to everyone. And they have the entire base theater jam packed full. And of course, ahead of time, they only send select few people to actually go listen and participate in these things because they have to have participation. But obviously, operations still have to go on at, you know, the main hub or wherever each command. So then I sent select few people. I decided to go, and I had written down my question on a sticky note ahead of time. And I did not filter my question through my chain of command, by the way, which they always want you to do. But when it came to question time, there's only a select few people that usually stand up because a lot of people are afraid to stand up and say something or ask their question because, again, guy's really high ranking. But he seems super down to earth, like super chill guy. I don't know. I was kind of in like the mid to back part of the very large theater, but I raised my hand and I asked a question specifically about CBD in the military. And the reason I asked this question is because as someone that was dealing with anxiety and depression and my own mental health challenges, I was exploring the world of CBD. I hadn't tried anything because I couldn't find any clear instructions on it, and I didn't want to pop on a drug test for it. But again, I couldn't find any clear instructions for it. And so, very valid question. I asked, what's the policy on CBD? And he turned around and he asked the CEO of the Naval Health Clinic that was on our base, well, what's the policy on CBD? She goes, oh, we just don't recommend. We don't recommend that service members use CBD. We don't recommend that they use lotions. He's like, but what's the actual instruction? Oh, well, there is none. We just don't recommend. He's like, oh. And what was interesting to me is he talked about how, I think he said his son or something had like a farm, like a marijuana farm or something. I don't know exactly every word that was said, but he, at the end of the day, he sounded like he was open-minded to the idea of CBD. And keep in mind, when I asked the question, I asked very specifically about 0% THC CBD to be used for medicinal purposes, because obviously CBD can be used for other purposes other than mental health. People use CBD for aches, for pains, you name it. And there are very pure forms out there that have been third-party tested. And I think I even threw those words in there, third-party tested 0% THC, but again, no instruction on it. So he said he'd go back and talk to the Surgeon General about it because there's no policy that's not acceptable. Anyway, like 3 months later, the Navy came out with a policy that said, no, you cannot do CBD in the military. And I think there's a twofold part to that. One, it's hard to regulate like who's using the right 0%, whatever, I mean, without like specifying brands. And then it gets deeper because now, you know, the military has to be affiliated with certain brands. So I get that to that point, right? But then also at the same point, I truly believe that, you know, there's a lot of money that big pharma filters into the military, and we push a lot of pharmaceutical drugs on our service members. I truly believe that the reason why my IBS existed, or maybe got worse, I don't know, I didn't really have those issues before the military, was because of the probably the ibuprofen was a huge part of it. I don't know all the like ins and outs of what ibuprofen does to the gut. I know it's not great for you, but I remember going to boot camp and getting prescribed 800 milligrams of ibuprofen because they asked me the question, do you get menstrual cramps? And I said, yes, I do. And they said, okay, cool. Here's 800 milligrams of ibuprofen. And about halfway through boot camp, I'm sitting there taking these 800 milligrams of ibuprofen and getting stomach aches in the middle of the night that woke me up. They were so severe and I had to stop taking it. And then I started taking it with food because I thought maybe it was food. And then, you know, anyway, I got off on a huge tangent there. But the point of this whole ramble and rant is that, you know, most people would have been afraid to speak up and even ask that question. And that question that clarified a huge thing for the military, that was a big deal. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with the decision. I feel like there should be more options for service members who want to explore alternative therapies or alternative medicines to really help with their mental health issues or their physical pain that they're experiencing. But again, I get it. It's not always as black and white as just like allow it or don't allow it. There's always layers to everything. So anyway, I wish that there were an avenue for people to be able to safely speak up about things and actually feel heard. Another example I'm going to give is there was an IG investigation at one of the last commands that I was at. There was an individual that I'd worked with that felt that there was racism rampant in the workplace. And I don't know all the ins and outs of the investigation that was done, but I do know that I was randomly pulled into my senior chief's office one day, and my senior chief, let me backtrack a little bit. There were like three other people in this room. I did not feel like it was a safe, comfortable space for me to be answering any questions, but he was just like, do you ever feel like you were, you know, discriminated against? Do you ever feel like anyone was racist towards you? Do you ever feel like this? And then every single example I gave, because I'm not like an on the spot thinker. If someone is like asking me these questions on the spot and wants answers, my brain draws a blank. And so anyway, any example that I was able to give, he was just immediately shooting it down. He was like, oh, well, no, that's that. Oh, I'm so glad that happened that way because this and that. And then as far as I know, that investigation didn't really go anywhere because the same people that were perpetuating this attitude that was causing a toxic work environment, nothing really happened. I remember telling a senior chief at one point that I watched this male in my group that I went out on a detachment with get harassed. And I didn't feel like he really was able to speak up or advocate for himself. And I gave names of people that were just acting very alpha to someone who was very beta. And I don't think anything really ever happened out of that. I mean, I could give example after example after example of times that either people were too afraid to speak up, or when someone did speak up, it just got dampened by the chain of command. Or, you know, someone felt like their interpretation mattered more than the person who went through its interpretation. And that's not okay. I think that, yeah, you know, when you're comparing something like that to something as extreme as the Stanford prison experiment, someone might look at the examples and be like, oh, well, someone being sadistic and, you know, taking it to that extreme level isn't in comparison to someone just not listening to someone. But I would argue otherwise, because I think the root underlying example that came out of the Stanford prison experiment was human behavior and what humans are capable of. And I think the military really perpetuates that. And so I find it really interesting that we're training people, instructors in SEER, that experiment, but we're not using these examples of the past and psychological experiments that were done to just teach leaders in the military that, you know, if you have this amount of power and you don't check yourself as a leader and as a human being, but you also don't check those around you and you don't hold each other accountable and hold each other to a standard, this is what can happen. You can really break people to the point that they become depressed. And we know depression is a thing. It's very rampant in the military. But then we also know that there's a high suicide rate in the military, which means that the problem is perpetuated even more, because to be in the amount of pain to want to take your own life because of your job and your environment and all the stress and not having that support, that's a problem. And, you know, you can tell me all day that there's the Brandon Act and that, you know, yeah, we took sexual assault out of the chain of command investigation and move. Okay, they're great. And I'm really happy that we're taking steps in the right direction, but I still think that there's a lot of work to do because there are still people taking their lives. There is still piss poor leaders. In fact, I just heard today an example of someone who is almost ready to pop, pregnant, and the military is trying to send her on a bus back home to her home state because she's getting ADCEPT. And I don't know this individual, I don't know the circumstances, but I mean, where's the humanity? Like, I don't know. I'm very disappointed in what the United States military is from a humanistic standpoint. They might be accomplishing the mission. I don't know. That's not my job. It really never was my job to know all the ins and outs of the missions. I just had to know my job. And, you know, one thing that my command was very good at, that I was at, you know, one of the last commands before I left, was accomplishing the mission. Very good at that. But that comes at an expense. And it came at the expense of a few lives. And it came at the expense of people's time, people's mental health, people's livelihood. And I think everyone has to look themselves in the eye at the end of the day and think, was it worth it? Was it worth that person's life? Was it worth that person's mental health? Was it worth that person being messed up for the rest of their lives? And maybe that is the conversation that leaders don't want to have in the military. Maybe that's it. Maybe at the end of the day, they don't want to look themselves in the eye and know that they were directly part of the pain that tons of people experienced. Because I never had that conversation. I told people about the overarching, like, general things that I went through, that I saw other people go through. And I really hoped that in my experiences that it would change some things for the better. I tried to leave my command with some suggestions. You know, when you check out of a command, you go through the chain of command, you have all these exit interviews and you tell them what happened and things, you know, things and stuff and whatnot. But I never had that genuine conversation of, I'm in a lot of pain because of what I went through at this command. I'm in a lot of pain because of the way that I was treated by this individual. And this is what happens to me. And this is what it did to me that causes me to feel this way. Maybe those are the human conversations we need to be having. And I wish it was just as simple as that. Again, you know, the response that a lot of leaders will give in the military. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of leaders that think that mental health is a joke. And so it's very difficult for anyone to have these humanistic conversations without feeling safe and without having that level of trust in the first place. But just like a light bulb moment in my head went off there. I'm like, you know, I wonder if 100 people in a command went up to their commanding officer and had a human conversation, broke down and said, I'm in pain every single day because this happened to me at this command and I don't want this to happen to anyone else. I wonder if that would change anything. It'd be pretty fucked up if it didn't, honestly. But I think when we look at from the outside in any situation, we don't feel the pain. We don't feel what someone's going through because we're not feeling those emotions because we can't feel other people's emotions. We never know exactly what someone's going through. Even if we might, you know, I cry when other people cry sometimes. I'm a huge sap ever since I had a baby. And so, you know, I'm a very empathetic, emotional person, but I'll never know exactly what someone is experiencing. But I would imagine that if I was leading a command and I thought everything was going really well, but I never took the time to get to know people, you're missing out on a huge opportunity to connect with people. And so if you are a leader in the military, I know I say this all the time and I say, you know, take your conversations beyond just like, how are you? Good. And you know, really get to know people. But I encourage once that safety is built up, you know, because you can't just go into conversations like this if people don't trust you. But, you know, take the time to get to know people, but I encourage you to have those difficult conversations and really, really get to know how people are doing that you're working around. And then at the same point, be humble enough to ask, what can I do better? But I'll say right now that if people do not trust you, they're not going to give you an honest answer to what you can do to be better. I know this because I had a chief at one of my last commands who asked this question. He said, what are some things that I'm doing good? What are some things that I'm doing bad? And I was very honest in my answers, but most people were like, no, I can't tell him what I think he's doing bad. But they all hated him at the same point. And I'm like, well, if he's asking you what he can do to improve and you hate him, why don't you use this as an opportunity to tell him what you could do or he could do better? And they're like, no, I can't do that. So again, here the disconnect. Building trust and in creating an environment where people feel safe is not always an easy thing to do in an environment like the military, but it is possible and it can be done. And that's just kind of a little gold nugget I wanted to leave you with today. If you're a leader that exists in the military today and you're just kind of looking for some actionable things that you can do to make the environment better, it just starts with conversations. It starts with genuinely being interested in who people are, what they're doing, what their lives are like without sounding like you're prying, like, you know, without sounding like I'm asking you this because I'm nosy or I'm asking you this because I have to know these things because I'm your leader. Cause that's how it always felt to me. Like I always felt like my leaders were just prying because they were nosy. I didn't ever feel like they were genuinely interested in what I was actually doing or genuinely wanted to help me. And so I became very closed off to sharing anything about my life with anyone when I was serving. But changing the culture takes small steps at a time. And that's really the biggest impact that we're going to make as individuals and as an organization. And it really starts with those small, small pieces that add up to affect an entire organization. So hopefully you learned something today. Go check out the Stanford Prison Experiment. Go watch some of the videos on it. It's really, really interesting. And there's a lot to be learned, whether you are military, whether you're a civilian, whether, you know, you are in a leadership role, or maybe you are being led by someone right now. There's a lot of things that you can take away from that. But then I hope you also took something away from all the other rambles and rants that I went on with this little talk today. I'm always trying to bring value back to the active duty community, but also the veteran community to help us be better. So let me know. There's a little Q&A section on Spotify that I don't really usually pay attention to that much, but let me know what your thoughts are on this episode. And let me know if you checked out the Stanford Prison Experiment, You can always reach out to me as well on Instagram _YSDEH. Of course, YouTube is where we are growing the fastest right now. If you would please take a few seconds, head over to YouTube _YSDEH, subscribe to the YouTube channel. That would absolutely mean the world. My goal is to hit 1,000 subscribers on the YouTube channel. And then of course, if you are not subscribed on Spotify or Apple, please also subscribe there and leave a 5-star rating and review, because that is what really spreads the word about the podcast and grows the popularity of it, which gets the message to people that need to hear it the most. And then the last thing that you can do is share the podcast, share the YouTube channel, because that also spreads the word to people who may need to hear this the most. So thank you for spending some time with me today and hanging out. Looking forward to some other incredible episodes that are coming up here in the very near future. And I'm excited to share those guests with you guys. So until next week, remember, your story matters and your story doesn't end here. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for taking the time to listen in today. With your support, we are able to increase awareness of the mental health issues affecting service members and veterans today, with the goal of creating positive change. If you got value from this episode, please take 30 seconds to subscribe and share this episode within your own network. Until next time, remember, your story matters, your mental health matters, and your story doesn't end here.